Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, Ellen Keane has the latest from the World Aquatics Championships. Conor Nyland chats tennis ahead of the Irish Open. Don McLean brings us the latest from the Galway races, while Mark Langdon has the latest football transfer news. And we'll speak to Shelburne Academy Director Colin Barron on funding obstacles in the League of Ireland. Plus, Shane Stokes reacts to the breaking news as Larry Gillespie earns an historic Tour de France podium finish. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Good evening, welcome along to the show. It is great to have your company of this Tuesday evening on 2FM. Only one place to begin this evening. Shane Stokes of the website Velo joins us on the line because Ireland's Larry Gillespie produced a superb ride on stage four of the Tour de France Femme on Tuesday today to earn an historic third placed finish. It has just happened in the last few moments. Shane Stokes, just how big of an achievement is this for Lara?
Oh, it's really big. It is really big because it's the first time for Irish women to be riding the Women's Tour de France. Lara's riding it along with Mia Griffin and Fiona Mangan. So there's three Irish women in the race. So it's huge that they're there in the first place. And then to get a podium finish for a rider as young as Lara in her first tour is astonishing. She finished just behind the two fastest riders in women's cycling, Lorena Weebs and Marianne Vos. And Lara was actually slightly impeded in the sprint and probably would have been closer to Marianne Vos, who was finished just ahead of her, had she not been. So it's really, really encouraging for the future. And this tour is all about building experience and just learning how good she can be. And I think on the base today, we can see that she's going to be really, really good.
Yeah, first women's Tour de France with an Irish presence, as we detailed with Larry Gillespie, current national champion Mia Griffin, and indeed last year's title holder Fiona Mangan, all present. Has this already surpassed expectations for Lara at the Tour?
Yeah, I think so, because realistically, to beat Lorena Weebs, I mean, Weebs, no rider really beats her in a straight-up sprint. Marianne Vos is recognised as the greatest rider of all time. She's got over 250 victories, and she acknowledged today that Lorena Weebs is practically unbeatable. So for Lara to be in that company is really, really good. And it just bodes so well for the future. She's only 24. She's shown talent throughout her career. She has European track championship wins at all age groups, age levels. So her potential has always been there. But she's really starting to deliver it now in the very biggest stage, which you don't get a bigger race than this. So to do that in her first tour is astonishing.
So a largely flat stage, peloton remaining tightly packed, 130 kilometres, closing stretch, showdown amongst the sprinters. Can Lara push on now? Like what's ahead this week?
Yeah, it gets hillier from now. So it's going to be, I think, possibly difficult because the climbing specialists will come to the fore more and more. Tomorrow's stage, it's quite hilly in the finale, so I think it'll thin it right down. So I think, unfortunately, yesterday was also a very good chance for Lara, and she and the other two Irish women were caught behind a crash and lost the chance of contesting the stage. If they can figure in the days ahead, that'll be really great, because it just gets progressively tougher from now on. As I said, the real aim for all three of them is this first tour is just to do as well as they can on the stages that suit them, and also just get experience that'll really stand to them in the years ahead. So even if Lara isn't as prominent in the remaining stages, I think she's already done really, really well and will take a lot from the race.
Okay, brilliant stuff. 106th in the general classification. For now, Shane Stokes of Velo website, thank you so much for detailing that. An historic third place for Lara Gillespie and a podium finish in today's stage of the Women's Tour de France. Just briefly, other news headlines today. Gary Ringrose will miss out on the chance of winning a test cap for the British and Irish Lions after being ruled out Saturday's final game against Australia due to concussion. The Lions returned to training this morning in Sydney. Joe McCarthy and Mack Hansen were involved in that session and are in contention to feature in Saturday's final game. And the gloom around Cork City has grown further after the club confirmed their brightest hope, 18-year-old Cathal O'Sullivan, suffered an ACL injury in last Friday's 3-2 defeat to Sligo Rovers. O'Sullivan is reportedly on the radar of several clubs, including Brentford, Crystal Palace and Celtic. So we certainly wish Cathal all the best with his recovery. Really unfortunate news there.
Game on. Swimming.
But we're turning our attention to swimming. Ellen Keane joins us now because an out-of-sorts Daniel Whiffen laboured his way to a place in the final of the 800-metre freestyle at the World Aquatics Championships in Singapore this morning. Whiffen, who's recovering from appendicitis, clocked 7 minutes 46.36 seconds to finish fifth in his heat and had a nerve-wracking wait to see if he would progress with the final heats. Results confirmed the Olympic 800-metre freestyle champion progressed in 8th overall and will have an outside lane for Wednesday's final, where he will look to defend the title he won at the Worlds in Doha in 2024. Ellen Keane in outside lane, 8 overall, not ideal, but if there's any man who can overcome appendicitis and just right all the wrongs, it's Daniel Whiffen.
It is Daniel Whiffen, yes, but thing is, if you have a lane, you have a chance. We've seen Olympic gold medals be won in lane 8. It's just a lane. Everyone's lane is the same. It doesn't really make an impact unless you're keeping an eye on the people around you. And to be honest, Daniel sticks to his race plan. He had the 400 metre on day one. He didn't make the final there. He didn't progress. And the first thing that he said when he got out of the pool was that he didn't stick to the race plan. So I think he kind of beat himself up a little bit about that. Going into the heat, he wanted to stick to the race plan of the 800 metres. He has said that when he got out of the water, he felt awful. He felt so weak. But then, like Daniel, he wants to figure out how he can get back to the best form that he can. I think he's been a little bit hard on himself. He did have appendicitis 5 weeks ago. He was in hospital for 2 days. He wasn't able to train. Even when he went back training, as soon as he got out of the hospital, he was saying that he felt awful. So the thing is, he has a champion's mindset. He wants to do well here. He is going to figure out how to be in the best shape possible. But I think we just have to kind of cut him some slack and not to put too much pressure on him, because he's going to put all the pressure on himself. But if anyone wants to watch that race, it's at 12 p.m. tomorrow, and they can watch it on Eurovision Sport online. I'm loving it at the moment because I can watch all the swimming online and swimming's
it's
hardly ever on TV.
It
is good coverage, yeah. And it's really exciting to see the Irish in action. And we had Mona McSharry in there as well doing the 100 metre breaststroke. Now, she was the fastest qualifier into the semi-final. She swam 105.99. It was PB plus 0.48, but to get that close to your PB that you swam in the Olympics is incredible, especially after having some time off. Now, in the semi-final, she did swim a 106.33, and that just goes to show you need to be consistent with swimming. You need, even though it might seem a bit silly, the amount of training that swimmers do, it's because of this reason. You need to be able to swim fast in the heats to make it to the semi-finals, be fit enough to swim in the semi-finals, and to be able to then perform and be fresh for the finals. Now, that's probably just catching up on Mona, and she did say she is a little bit disappointed, but she's looking forward to the 200 breaststroke. She'll be back in action on Thursday, so we'll see a little bit more of her. And then she's got the 50 meter breaststroke later on in the week. We also had an Irish senior record broken by Ellen Walsh in the 200 medley. She did a great job. And she would have been disappointed now with her final swim, where she came eighth overall and went to 2:11.57. But again, Ellen is one of these people who has a champion mindset like Daniel. Now, she mightn't be as loud as Daniel and as as confident maybe in the media, but she is a fighter. Her main event is the 400 medley. To be able to make the final, it's her first World Championship final in the 2IM. To be so able,
you
to
can't
make,
be that disappointed. Okay, you finish eighth in the final, but it's your first World Final.
I know, but swimmers always want to get PBs. It's all about those PBs, and she did in the heat, and or she did in the semi final, and I guess you always want that little bit more, and that's she'll go back now and watch that on replay and figure out if I had been a little bit tighter, if I had maybe paced a little bit better. But she's a 400 medley, that's her main event, and it'll be really exciting to see her perform in that.
Okay. You imagine you learn a lot, even if it's not your preferred event or your main event. You're going to learn a lot from getting into a final of a World Championships as well. Evan Bailey equaling an Irish record yesterday too. Just a note, there's no Irish swimmers in action this evening. As you mentioned, Ellen Walsh, Daniel Hill and Evan Bailey will take the blocks tomorrow in Singapore. What else has caught your eye from the Irish perspective?
Do you know what? It actually was Evan Bailey absolutely smashing the Irish record. Like 146.44 is fast. The 200 freestyle in swimming is one of those kind of superior events where all of the lads try to be as big as possible, as muscly as possible, as fast as possible. It's one of those that, like, if you're a 200 freestyle, it's really impressive, and that's what the lads try and perform well at. It's the 50 freestyle, 100 freestyle, and 200 freestyle. So it is really, really competitive. So he really stood out to me there. Unbelievable job. 16th in the semi-final. Like, it's hard to swim fast in the heat and then try and replicate that in the final or the semi-final, especially when it's such a shocking kind of a shocking PB. He took so much time off. But, like, I think overall Team Ireland are doing really, really well. We had Jack Casson. He got a PB in the 200 butterfly earlier today as well. So he did a really good job. I think just the standard that the Irish swimmers are at the first year after a Games is really exciting, especially, like, going back to Mona. She's had some time off and she's still swimming close to her PB, and she's still, like, the 100 metre breaststroke. We saw Lily King, who's Olympic champion, Ruta Malatute, who's Olympic champion, didn't progress from the semi-finals.
Okay, so it's a lot of competition.
It is hard, yeah. And I think especially the year after a Games, kind of the younger guys or the guys with a little less experience kind of take advantage of the guys who went to the Olympics and try and get ahead of them and try and make that little bit of an extra gain and get to the wall before them in the heats and the semis and try and squeeze their way in. It's an opportunity kind of for the younger guys to make the semis, to make the finals, and they're going to take advantage of that. Ellen McCartney, she didn't swim on her PB, but she swam PB plus 5.9, and she's had a great season, so she cannot be unhappy with her season so far. I'm really looking forward to Friday because we'll have the 50 metre freestyle, so we'll have Shane Ryan up against Tom Fannin. As I said before last week, this will be an exciting head-to-head for the two Irish competitors. It's always exciting to see Irish athletes compete against each other. And it's going to be a little, okay, we want to make the semis, we want to make the finals here, but we also want to beat each other. So it'll be really interesting to watch that one.
It's nice to have those extra narratives. So best of luck to Danielle Hill, Evan Bailey, Ella Mulsh tomorrow, and indeed to Daniel Whiffen in that final. Hopefully he is recovered and goes well in the 800 metre freestyle. For now, Ellen Walsh, thank you as always for detail. Ellen Keane, apologies.
It's
apologies,
right.
Ellen Keane.
Ellen
Walsh.
Confused.
Ellen Walsh, because I'm wishing Ellen Walsh all the best after such a brilliant performance, and we're hoping that continues in the World Aquatics Championships in Singapore. Ellen Keane, thank you very much for detailing all of that. We're taking a short ad break and we're turning our attention to racing with Dom McLean.
Game on. Racing.
Now, the Galway races is ongoing. Don McLean joins us on the line now. There has been racing to review, but before we do that, looking ahead to today's feature, goes to post in what, just over 20 minutes time at 6:40. Don McLean, what should we be keeping an eye out on?
Yeah, it's a really interesting race, Shane. This Colin Quinn BMW mile, and I suppose the Dermot well-trained horse Corridor, he's got a big chance. I think he's got a kind of a wide draw to overcome, but a wide draw, it's not always a negative in this race. It's they normally go fast early on, and he's running this race twice before. He won it 2 years ago. He ran well to finish fourth in the race last year, and he's a horse who he's a real honest to God horse who always gives his all, and he's a horse who goes well at Galway, and that's obviously it's a massive element in your favour if you're already proven at Galway. You've got Mississippi River in there for Aidan O'Brien. He ran well last time at Leopardstown to finish fourth behind Steve Binion, who's in there as well. He's a really progressive horse of David Marnan's. He's won his last two. And Norwalk Havoc, the rain that fell yesterday, Shane, that'll probably suit Norwalk Havoc. He finished second in the race last year. He's racing off just a £3 higher mark. That's Jessica Harrington and Shane Foley. So he's a big player in the race. But look, it's a really open race. But I think Corridor could go really well. He's a 9-year-old, but he proved the last day that he retained all his enthusiasm for racing. And yeah, I can see him going all right.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that, and we will be chatting to you later to review that. But reviewing the rest of today's action so far, it all got underway at 5:05. What's been happening today, Don?
Yeah, three races so far, Shane, this evening. And Stick to the Plan sprang a little bit of a surprise in the opening race in the Colin Quinn BMW Novices Hurdle. The market kind of centred around the Willie Mullins horses, La Note Verte and Vicker Street. But Stick to the Plan, given a really good ride by Ricky Doyle, stayed on best of all. And he was sent off a 22-1 shot, but he won well in the end. And then the Beginners' Chase, the Latin Quarter Beginners' Chase, that was a really interesting race. King of Kingsfield won that for Gordon Elliott. and Jigginstown has and Jack Kennedy. He's only had one run over fences before this. We probably know him better as a hurdler, but he's a classy hurdler. He's rated 100 in the 140s over hurdles. And when my great mate, Willie Mullins horse, when he went on over the last and up the hill, he did look the likely winner. But as we know, this hill of Galway, it's a steep old hill. And many a race has changed complexion from the final fence around the home turn and up the final hill to the winning line. But King of Kingsfield, he saw it out well. He was strong all the way to the line. And just there a couple of minutes ago, pivotal attack for Joe Murphy and Gary Carroll. Joe Murphy's horses are in tremendous form, and she won the Fillies maiden. She was very, very good. Amelia Earhart, Aidan O'Brien's filly, she got out in front and she kicked on off the home turn. They didn't go at great pace in the early part of the race, but Gary Carroll had pivotal attack, always handy, and she was good. She went to the line really strongly. She picked up well. She showed a lot of pace and a really good attitude as well to come away from Amelia Earhart on the run up the hill. So she was impressive in winning that juveniles medal. But there have been 10 races in total so far, Shane, 7 last night and 3 tonight so far. There have been 10 different winning trainers and 10 different winning riders.
Wow, well, that was brilliant. It's always good to see a bit of competition in racing. What's rare is wonderful. Galway play tomorrow, Don. What catches your eye?
Yeah, look, I suppose Nürburgring is the big story, Shane. He won the Galway Hurdle last year, and he's going to try and be the first horse since Ansar back in 2004. Ansar won the place. He won the Hurdle, I think, 3 years earlier, but Nürburgring was good in winning the Hurdle, the Galway Hurdle last year. He's a little bit higher in the handicap now over fences than he was then, but he's still unexposed over fences. He's only had 5 runs, and for me, it's taken him a little while to be as fluent over his fences as he is over his hurdles, but he was very good the last day at Killarney over 2 miles and a furlong. And that's probably a trip that's short of his best. Stepping up and trip to 2 miles and 6.5 furlongs, the distance over which the plate has run, then that could see him take a nice step forward. So it'd be great if he could go and bridge the gap back to Ansar back in the early 2000s. But again, wide open race. The company sergeant is in there for Gavin Cromwell. Gordon Elliott has a very strong hand. Down memory lane probably heads up Gordon Elliott's charge. And you've got Anyway in there for Ken Buds, who ran such a massive race at the Cheltenham Festival when he finished second behind Caldwell Potter in a novices chase there. And Jazzy Matty for Kian Collins, young, very astute trainer, Kian Collins. Jazzy Matty was also a Cheltenham Festival winner. Actually, he's a dual Cheltenham Festival winner. And he hasn't run since he ran the hurdle race at the Punchestown Festival back in early May. But again, he's a horse who should stay the trip really well. And Harry Cobden has been booked for the ride. So I think Jazzy Matty's a big player there as well.
Okay, Don, just before we let you go, stepping away from Galway, Goodwood Cup Stakes, the Group 1. Aidan O'Brien had a 1-2?
He did, yeah. No, it was really a thrilling finish between the two of them, actually, and Scandinavia got the better of Illinois. Illinois, he's the 4-year-old who ran in the Ascot Gold Cup, who finished second in the Ascot Gold Cup behind Trawlerman. He was dropping down a trip to 2 miles. Scandinavia, he's the kind of up-and-coming horse. He's only a 3-year-old, and the last 3-year-old to win the Goodwood Cup, Shane, was Stradivarius, and he was so good, he went and he won the next 2 or 3 as well. And before Stradivarius, you have to go back 35 years to find the previous 3-year-old. So, like, not many 3-year-olds run in the race, but Scandinavia, you have to be a really tough type of 3-year-old. They do get away, or an age, or a weight allowance for their age, but Scandinavia was tough, and he stayed on really well for Wayne Norton just to get the better of Illinois in as you say, a 1-2 for Aidan O'Brien.
Okay, great stuff. Don McLean, thank you so much for joining us. We will be returning to Don at the end of the show to recap the Colm Quinn BMW Mile Handicap that goes to post at Galway at 6:40. We're taking a short ad break, and then Mark Langdon is standing by to wrap up all of the latest European transfer news.
Game on. Association football.
Now, as is tradition of a Tuesday, Mark Langdon joins us with all the latest football news, and we are in transfer season. So, Mark Langdon, let's begin our conversation. Aston Villa's Ollie Watkins and RB Leipzig's Benjamin Sesko are at the top of Manchester United's list of strikers if they decide to bring in further reinforcements during the current transfer window. I would imagine this is all dependent on United being able to dispose of Rasmus Højlund.
Well, I think it's definitely disposing of some players, Shane. So Garnacho would be one that they, you know, would be desperate to get rid of. They might need to, you know, who would want Højlund, I suppose, is another question for the kind of money that Manchester United paid. Would they need to sell a club-trained player? Kobbie Mainoo, been linked with, moves away. But there's no doubt that Manchester United need a focal point to their attack. I think they've done some, you know, brought in some good players. I think you can question the value and sort of if they've overpaid slightly for Cunha and Bueno, but you know, they are Premier League sort of proven. I think they improved Manchester United, but neither of them really wants to play as a central striker. And you know, for all that Højlund showed potential when he first arrived, completely lost his confidence. And if United want to make sort of serious inroads, you know, up to the kind of Premier League positions that they think that they should be aiming for, they are going to need a centre forward to knit everything together. We've spoken previously about Aston Villa and them being quite close to PSR kind of rules, and that might be why you know, Ollie Watkins is being looked at as a potential departure for them. We, you know, Emi Martinez is another one that's been linked with moves away. But you know, it's Sesko for potential, it's Ollie Watkins for you know what you're going to get. So I think if you're United, if you're probably Ruben Amorim, you're thinking Ollie Watkins, because you want to move up that table quickly, and you don't want to be wanting Sesko to be, you know, kicking his heels and maybe not being right up to the standard from the first whistle, because if United don't start well, what happens to Ruben Amorim?
They've taken enough gambles and transfers of late, certainly Manchester United. We're still in the need of five or six players. Those were the words of David Moyes after he confirmed the club had made an offer for Bayern Munich's teenage defender, Adam Asnew. Will Jack Grealish be one of the five or six players David Moyes alludes to?
Well, I can't say definitely, but I think he's a player that Everton are looking at. You know, Grealish, fall from grace, been spectacular, really. You know, he's part of a successful City side that won the treble, cost 100 million before that, and barely got a look in, really, last season, then wasn't even taken onto the Club World Cup squad. So he's definitely, you know, available. We all know that. He's kind of been chopping around, really, in sort of the mid-table Premier League area. West Ham have been linked with a move for Jack Grealish as well. I would like to see him play at Everton, because I think Everton need a sprinkling of stardust in their new stadium, somebody that's going to get everybody excited. You alluded to the fact there that Moyes wants new players and is desperate to bring in, you know, some particularly, I would say, attacking threat into the team. Grealish definitely gives you that. And also, Jack Grealish, this is a World Cup year. If he's got any hope of going to the World Cup with England, he needs to be playing week in, week out. So, with all due respect to Everton, if you do go to Everton, you probably are going to play you know, every minute that you're available if you're Jack Grealish. So, I think it would be a sensible enough move for Jack Grealish, but he maybe has to eat a little bit of humble pie dropping so far down the table.
Talk to me about the curious case of Alexander Isak. Will he be a Newcastle United player come the start of the season?
I think it's hard for him, Shane, to stay at Newcastle after the fuss that he's kicked up. You know, he's refused to travel onto their tour to the Far East. Clearly wants to move on, presumably, to Liverpool. You know, I think sort of through his intermediaries, he's suggesting that he was promised that he'd be able... you know, he was promised a new contract that then didn't arrive, and now he wants to, inverted commas, explore his options. You know, I think not often the club wins out in these battles, and that you probably are better off selling an asset, even a prized one like Isak, if he's on the verge of refusing to play, because it rarely bodes well. You know, there are enough players out there. Just, you just mentioned two, Watkins and Sesko, that could go in potentially at Newcastle. So I'm edging towards the fact he'll be a Liverpool player. I'm sure that would excite Liverpool fans everywhere, really, because they're already the best team and they might be signing, you know, one of the best players that would be on the market this summer.
Chelsea's Joao Felix set to join El Nassr. Will he ever fulfil his potential?
No. I think that's gone now. I think he made a bad move when he joined Atletico Madrid for... That was around about 100 million when he left Portuguese football to go to Atletico Madrid. Diego Simeone never really gets the best out of that type of player, and a crucial part of his development, he was playing for a team that was all about physicality, all about defending, you know, defending and putting pressure on opponents when you haven't got the ball. And I always felt that Felix was sort of more of a free spirit and would have sort of enjoyed his football if he would have just gone somewhere where he wasn't in such a rigid formation. He's then had kind of, you know, moves where he's never settled time after time. I'm very surprised that Chelsea have managed to get 44 million from him from Saudi Arabian club. You wonder what the next highest bid was because I suggest there weren't too many in that queue. So well done to Chelsea for getting as much as they can. They seem to be able to do that quite often with their players.
Luis Diaz to Bayern Munich, a done deal?
Yeah, I mean, it is, I think. I think Diaz is a good player, but if you're Liverpool for 65 million, I think it's the right time to sell him. I'm sure he will be impactful for Bayern for the next couple of years, but you know, he's coming towards sort of late 20s now, probably not got that much improvement left in him. They've already got Ekitike. You know, we've spoken there that they want Isak as well. So I think it makes sense if you're Liverpool to sell Diaz. And you know he's a good player, and it's not about kind of him leaving because Liverpool don't rate him. But you've got to know when to sell these players, particularly with PSR now. You need to be turning profit at times. And I think Liverpool are, you know, the best run club around, and that they always know when to sell and when to buy.
Okay, just very, very briefly, Granit Xhaka to Sunderland. Can he make an impact on the Premier League at this stage of his career?
Yeah, I mean, Sunderland, full of youth, but they need some experience. And Xhaka, you know, he knows the Premier League. He played superbly for Bayer Leverkusen. I'm amazed that he's going to Sunderland. But yeah, I think he'll make a big impact for them.
Okay, great stuff. Mark Langdon, thank you so much for detailing all of that. Just to mention as well, Derry City have brought in defender Jamie Stott from Crisis Club Morecambe. The 27-year-old has joined the Brandywell club on an 18-month deal, offering a new option as a left-sided centre-back for manager Tiernan Lynch. Meanwhile, midfielder Kieran Harkin is the latest player to join Sligo Rovers, departing the Brandywell. Harkin signs with Sligo until the end of this season, with the club retaining an option on the player for next year. We are chatting tennis with Conor Nyland, and we're going to hear from Shelburne Academy director Colin Barron after the break as well, a little bit later on. And we're crossing back live to Don McLean at the Galway Races. Lots more to come here in Game On. Stick with us.
Game On. Tennis.
Now, today sees the start of the main draw of the Irish Open Tennis Championships in Carrick Mines. While these days it's a relatively small event on the ITF Futures Tour, it's still a title with extraordinary history, with the first Irish Open dating back to 1879, making it one of the oldest tournaments in the world, predating all the Grand Slam events outside of Wimbledon. Long gone are the days, maybe, when the very best players in the world took part, but it's still quite a spectacle with the best of the Irish men and women taking part. Conor Nyland, the former Grand Slam tournament player and Irish Davis Cup captain, joins us on the line now. Conor, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us. What can we expect this week?
Hi Shane, yeah, thanks for having me on. Well, it's not been up there the last couple of days. It's the best players in Ireland. So we have Michael Agwi and Peter Baldurini, Conor Gannon, Amara Lamont, sort of the core of maybe the Davis Cup team, the last tie, and we've got a tie coming up against China in September, and we've also got a women's 15,000 as well, so another Billie Jean King Cup team. But obviously you've got international players as well, and as you said, Shane, we had, I guess, a history in the 50s and 60s where this was a pre-Wimbledon event, the Irish Open, and it was a big event on the international calendar. It's now a $15,000 futures event, which I guess is the lowest rung of professional tennis. So it's an opportunity for junior players to get experience and maybe get ATP or WTA points. We actually had a 14-year-old girl called Leah Puck who qualified and won her first round of main draw today. So I guess while I would love to see the big time back again, this serves a purpose for a certain cohort of players when they're starting out in their career. I guess if you look at maybe some of the countries who are comparable to us in terms of size, like a Belgium or a Holland or a Denmark, they might have five or six of these a year, plus a couple of challenger events. But importantly, then they also have a main tour event, which is something that the sport can really kind of, I guess, they can really harness an atmosphere around that. And I guess a $15,000 futures doesn't quite do that in the same way, but even though it does serve a purpose for a certain group of players.
When you look at the Irish player rankings for both men and women, it's fair to say they have slipped back in the last few years. You yourself, you got the 129th in the world, played singles at Wimbledon and the US Open. Now there's no Irish presence in the top 500 in the world, few enough in the top 1,000. What do you put that down to?
Yeah, we've definitely slipped back. I think Michael, as I said, is number one at about 600. I guess when I was playing, we had would have had two futures and a challenger event. So sort of 2006, 2008, there was a $75,000 challenger event, which I would have gotten a wild card into 1 year, a couple of futures events built around that. So I guess there was sort of a summer or at least a month of tennis that you could sort of build around. That's now obviously been reduced to 1 week. In fairness, the junior offer in terms of international events in Ireland has actually improved in the last two or three years. So when I was an under 18, we used to have maybe two or three under 18 world ranking events. Now that's improved to about six or seven under 18. We've also got more under 14. So that has improved. We may have an outside chance of having a couple of our under 18 and under 16 at the Australian Open in January, which would be a big improvement. I mean, ultimately, I think we don't produce top class tennis players because we don't produce the top class juniors. So I think what we need to be aiming for is getting regularly having players in junior Grand Slams. And they're ultimately hopefully going to develop into top 250, top 200 players. We probably shouldn't be, for now, focusing on getting players into the top 20 or top 50. We should probably just think, can we get players into Grand Slam qualifying rounds and then build from there? So hopefully that can happen. But I think one $15,000 futures event a year won't get it done, unfortunately. So hopefully we can keep building on it.
There's been a lot of goodwill towards the sport and generated largely by the Davis Cup match in Limerick against Austria last year. It seems like there is an appetite among the public for tennis of high standard. Like that match was a 2,400 sellout. Has anything been built on after that experience, which you were the centre of, in terms of momentum, in recognising that top class tennis is something that is appealing to an Irish sporting audience?
Yeah, well, Limerick was incredible in that it was a sellout, 2,500 Saturday, 2,500 Sunday, and it sold out in about half an hour. And I think it even took us by surprise. We knew there was going to be some interest in Dominic Thiem, who won US Open, was a part of it, which helped. We thankfully have another home tie against China in September at the Sport Ireland campus. We'll be building a court, again, similar to Limerick. But yeah, we haven't, I guess, been able to capitalise on it in the sense that there hasn't really been another big event in Ireland. The futures event that we had this year, we had something similar last year. But for me, I think we need at least a challenger event, if not a WTA or ATP event, to really capture the public's attention. People want to see top 100, top 50 players. And no matter how much you promote a futures event, ultimately people aren't going to go and necessarily travel to see somebody 300-400 in the world, even though they're amazing players. It just doesn't have the crossover. So if we can somehow create events that have top 100, top 50 players, the people will come, because that's been proven, as I say, in Limerick. And I think, again, in terms of the noise around the China tie in September and people's interest in tickets, they aren't on sale yet, but they will be soon. It seems to be that there's really good interest again in that because China have three guys in the top 100.
Finally, Conor, if we come back to the Irish Open, what are the chances of an Irish winner? Because I would imagine that would be a small, but certainly a significant step.
Yeah, there is a chance. I mean, again, it's on artificial grass, which is something that's a little bit unusual on the future circuit. Mostly it's clay or hard court. So I think the Irish guys have a little bit of an advantage in that obviously we've grown up on it and a lot of the players haven't. And home support as well. So look, Michael Agui, he's 600 in the world at the moment. He's had a tough year in that he started the year at about 450. He made quarterfinals of a challenger event last year at the age of 21. That suggests that when he's 23, 24, he's at a level where he could be winning challengers. And that means hopefully a top 200, top 250 career. So Michael on his game can, and has proven he's beaten a bunch of top 200 guys in the last couple of years. So he's proven to be able to play at that level. So if he can get through the first round or two and get settled, he definitely has a chance. But there's a group of them that hopefully could have a run.
Okay, great. So as I mentioned, today sees the start of the main draw of the Irish Open Tennis Championships in Carrick Mines. For now, Conor Nyland, thanks so much for taking the call.
Game on. Tennis. Game on. Association football.
Now, beginning this Thursday, RTE presents Football Families, a three-part documentary series featuring Shelburne Football Club's most promising young talent from across the country as they strive to make it as professional footballers. The series offers unique behind-the-scenes access to Shelburne film during their historic 2024 season under then-manager Damien Duff. Each episode of Football Families tells the stories of different young players and their families whose lives revolve around football. These teenagers are committed to achieving their dreams in the face of extreme pressure, injuries and setbacks. I'm delighted to say that Shelburne Academy director, who features prominently in this series, Colin Barron, joins us on the line now. Colin, thanks so much for taking the time to chat. What is an average day of a League of Ireland Club Academy director?
A lot of phone calls, a lot of organising and planning, a lot of strategising towards whether it's evening training sessions, weekends, you know, implementing the curriculum, and then alongside some of the not so fancy stuff with parents meetings, player meetings, anything can really happen to, you know, organising buses on the weekends for away games and everything else that comes with it, you know.
Quite, I would imagine, all consuming. And the industry in, say, England and across Europe is obviously going to be much bigger than Ireland. But they do have practically a full-time training environment from the age of 16, whereas we don't here. So how do you bridge the gap, and what can League of Ireland clubs offer players to ensure they are receiving the best development?
It's extremely challenging. That age bracket of 16 to 18, there seems to be a growing gap between what we can do and what European clubs are doing. Look, we do double sessions on a Tuesday. We've been doing that for the last 2.5 years. Our young National League players from under 14 all the way through to under 20 are in 2:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday. They leave school early to do that. They do 2 pitch sessions, gym session. They're fed on site. They then have time to catch up on their homework, which is supervised. And then, you know, they're back out for a second session with their team in the evening. So we are trying to bridge the gap as much as we possibly can. But it's extremely difficult when you haven't got the resources and the staff resources and the infrastructure to give the players the best opportunity, especially at them key ages between the ages of 16 and 18. The gap just seems to grow massively.
And does this all then come back to finances? And I know there's ongoing work, and Will Clark is doing absolutely Trojan work within the FAI, Will Clark, head of League of Ireland Academy Development. Now, he did say earlier this year that the situation is time critical, stressing Ireland will fall even further behind its European counterparts if action isn't taken. You're involved, you're hands-on with all of this at Shelburne. Do you feel we're at a breaking point here? You're overseeing top talent being nurtured.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every single day that goes by is critical, to be honest. And it's something that the academy managers in all the clubs have been harping on about for the last 3 years. Obviously, Will is doing brilliant work and is, you know, banging that drum for us at government level. And I know that there's been a big push for the last couple of years around that. But look, I was at an ECA meeting, a European Clubs Association meeting in Madrid 3 months ago with Luke Byrne, the technical director. Benfica were there, Ajax were there as guest speakers, talking about what they're doing with their young players. And I think the real concerning part for me around listening to them is that they continue to evolve. They've got such big budgets that they're evolving at a much faster rate than we can even try to close the gap to a starting point. So that's the real concern for me. The most basic of standards that they have with regards to being able to offer full-time football at the age of kind of 16 is basic and has been happening there for 15, 20 years. They're talking about the problem that we all suffer with now with regards to there's not enough kids playing on the street. Obviously, socially, the world has changed. They're on their phones more, but the likes of Ajax, for example, they talked about how they developed, and Benfica, in Nice, where the kids play street football. So everything is so organised and structured here that it's difficult for players to even, you know, spend them hours themselves on the street or out in the green or whatever. But them clubs around Europe, they actually have seen that and they've gone, we've got an issue here. We're not developing creative players enough, even though they seem fantastically developed to us. So they create these sessions where it's like unorthodox play, street football, heads and volleys, all the things we used to do. And they've actually started to pinpoint that as something that's part of their curriculum and their development of the players. So it's just, it's phenomenal when you hear things like that, and worrying as well.
Do you feel that could work within the League of Ireland setup, or within Ireland? Or is a barrier or an obstacle the fact that underage football in Ireland is extremely fractured?
Look, I think the development of the underage national league has been brilliant. I think that I've been involved in schoolboy football now for 20 years coaching in the country. I think the evolution of the National League academies has developed certainly more professional standards. I think the clubs are trying to do almost everything they can with limited resources. Is football fractured? I would say there's certainly not continuity across the board in what's happening in the country. You only have to look at the fact that you go to somewhere like Cork and you've got kids at 8, 9, 10 years of age who actually aren't playing league games, aren't playing football week to week. That to me is mind-boggling. And unless we can get them sort of things correct, well, then we're always going to be playing catch-up with the players. Always. And that's a worry also.
Are you confident with the structures currently in place, or do they still need to be developed and tinkered and tweaked?
I think they absolutely need to be tweaked and developed. Obviously, there's an auditing process going on at the moment with Double Pass, who were, I suppose, implemented through Sport Ireland and the FAI to audit the academies. I actually don't like the word audit. I've found it thoroughly enjoyable. It's like free consultation. They're giving you massive advice and an insight into the structures and developments around academies in Europe. I think that that's a critical framework to give us a real starting point as to where we're actually at. And I think off the back of that, then we can start to hopefully get government funding, which will allow us to implement some of the structures that are needed to develop players better. It's as simple as that.
So that audit or consultation has to be completed by August 15th, and that's a proposal worth up to €8 million per year to be submitted in time for the budget that can go into League of Ireland academies. You obviously sound pleased, and it's positive communication in that regard. Are you confident that that will be completed and be up to standard?
Yeah, I think so. I think the big thing about it, these guys are extremely professional, and the people you're talking to within the audit process are football people, as in they've been directors of football or academy directors in, or technical directors in some cases, within clubs around Europe. So they understand football, so they understand the gaps that are there. And it's really, they're looking for a true insight. They're not looking for you to, you know, I suppose, paper over the cracks and say, oh, this is what we have, but actually we don't. And they're quite thorough in that. And I think, I would hope as a result of that, yes, there will be funding, but I think it's really critical at that point also that that's where the system gets tweaked, Shane. I think that that's massively important, where the best players, even within the current academy system, and the clubs who are doing it right, have to be rewarded. They have to be the ones who are said, okay, if it's 4 clubs, if it's 8 clubs, if it's 12 clubs, right, as a result of this audit and process, these clubs are doing not everything perfect, but they're really trying to implement the right structures. They're the ones who should be rewarded to develop our best players at this time. And then players need to be playing against each other consistently within them academy structures.
When you look at the facilities that are needed for all of this to thrive, and I know you're Shelburne Academy Director, you're not over the League of Ireland, but for Shells, what's the current situation? They're in the process of buying some of the AUL to kind of nurture that as a permanent home for the academy?
Yeah, so look, we've signed an 18-year lease with the AUL, and we will have our own full-size Astro built in that by Christmas of this year, which is another massive step for us. We've taken over 4 pitches, and that's the first step. There's kind of a structured process that will take out, or will continue on for probably a 4 or 5 year period, where we'll continue to develop what we've, agreed within the lease. And then that will be a massive step for us, because we'll have more control, more contact hours, more ability to do a lot more with the players. So that will be a massive step for us.
When you look at some of the players that you're overseeing now, listen, we see 16-year-old Michael Noonan scoring for Rovers in Europe, Mason Mealy departing for Spurs in January, a deal worth €1.7 million could potentially rise to €4 million. What is the talent like at Shells at the moment? There was 6 academy players making a senior debut in a recent cup match as well, against Fairview Rangers.
We've got a lot of quality young players in the club. It's taken time to build that. You know, we've had the likes of Gavin Malloy, who came through the academy late, you know, got into the first team, played a lot, and then successfully went and signed for Aberdeen. You've had Steph Negru before that. But I think overall what's happened is we've had a massive improvement in quality in the last few years. I think the work that we've done and the coaches do on a week-to-week basis with regards to our double sessions, our contact time, has massively improved over the last 2 to 3 years. And we're just starting to see the fruits of that. So our under-17s team, which feature in the series, they went undefeated last year. They've qualified for the UEFA Youth League. They'll play in that now as an under-18s, 19s squad in September. I feel now for us, it's really important to be developing players for the Premier Division and beyond. And I think we're in a strong position to start doing that. And I believe that we've got a lot of quality young players in the club at the moment.
Is the priority nurturing players for Shelburne's first team or to produce players to end up in England and create revenue for the club in that regard?
I think that happens as a natural process, Shane. Like, our ambition is very clear as a club within the academy. It's to try to develop elite players. Obviously, we've seen the success of the first team at the moment playing in Europe. So the ambition is hopefully we develop a better training ground. We get resources into the club and finances. We can then start developing the structure around the player. And maybe it doesn't become as necessary for the player to go to the UK or Europe. So we would love our players to step into Shelburne first team, play there for 2 or 3 years, and then potentially go to the UK or Europe. That's certainly the ambition.
I must credit Sean O'Connor, journalist with the Irish Independent, for this now. This kind of just put into a broader context for our listeners. In April of last year, Will Clark's annual presentation about the state of play in Ireland included the fact that there are just 10 full-time academy staff employed in Ireland compared to, say, Poland's 376 and Croatia's 190. Ireland were also among the 4 UEFA nations with less than 1 full-time academy employee per club at the time. The other 3, Northern Ireland, Andorra and Luxembourg. When you hear stats like that, how demoralising is it from your point of view, given the hard work that you're putting in on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's extremely stark to hear them figures, but it is factual, you know? It is factual. So, look, I think the big picture for everybody should be, like, I remember Italia 90, USA 94, Saipan, that inspiration that young players get to play for Ireland's, it just, that stage creates something that's really unique. And as I said, like, football is continuing to evolve around Europe, and it just seems like it's stagnated here, and it doesn't seem like enough people care, you know, at the top. There's been a lot of talk, like I said, for 2 or 3 years around government funding, etc. But it seems baffling to me that, you know, you see an Evan Ferguson who's obviously gone to Roma at the moment, and you just think, like, you know, the fruits of that is incredible for the country, you know, the lift that gives young kids to have Evan as an icon. We need to be developing 10 Evan Fergusons over the next 5 to 10 years, and that can only happen through the clubs. So it needs to be supported. It just needs investment to do that. And I don't understand why there hasn't been that ambition and drive to get that investment into the clubs.
So key dates, August 15th is when the audit of League of Ireland Academies needs to be completed by. That may open up €8 million in terms of funding for these League of Ireland Academies for the future of Irish football as well. Another key date this Thursday, 10 past 10, RTE1 and the RTE Player, the first of this 3-part documentary series, Football Families. Colin Barron, Shelburne Academy Director, thank you so much for taking the call this evening.
Game on. Association Football.
Now, as promised, we can cross back live to Don McLean because we were previewing today's feature at the Galway Races, the Colm Quinn BMW Mile Handicap. And in the words of Fran Berry, big money Hef has taken home the big pot, Don.
He sure has, Shamie Heffernan. And it was a masterclass from Shamie Heffernan. He rode Dunham for Natalia Lupini, and it was a super ride. Dunham, he's a horse. He does love Galway. He had a nice draw on the inside. Shamie Heffernan got him out. He kind of missed the break a little bit, but Shamie Heffernan just gave him a squeeze. He got onto the front end. And once he got there, he dropped anchor. He stacked them up in behind. He made it very difficult for horses who are further back or wider out to make ground, and then he kicked off the home turn. And it's a long pull from the crown of the home turn up the hill to the winning line at Galway. But when you have a horse like Dunham who loves it and who was able to race within his comfort zone for much of the race under Shamey Heffernan, he kicked Bear Prophet Game at him, Gerald Leary's horse under Nicola Burns, and he just failed by a head to get him. He was closing all the way to the line, but Dunham just had enough in hand. And he loves it here, Shane. We were talking earlier on about Galway and Galway specialists. He's run here now five times. He's won three times and finished third twice. And he'll probably run again, all going well, in the Ahenora Handicap over 7 furlongs. This is over a mile or an extended mile, over 7 furlongs on Sunday. And you could argue that he's possibly even a better horse over 7 furlongs of Galway than he is over a mile.
Okay, just that briefly, Don, just to finish, because yesterday the Galway races opened with the sad newsing of the passing of legendary trainer Edward O'Grady, an absolute great of the sport.
A phenomenal trainer, Shane, and a remarkable, I mean, you could just tell the tributes that were paid to him yesterday by the icons of the sport, Aidan O'Brien, JP McManus, Willie Mullins, Jessica Harrington, Norman Williamson. He was having winners at the Cheltenham Festival when the Irish just didn't have winners at Cheltenham. We're looking at, you know, 18, 19, 20 winners every year these days. But back then, there were 2, 3, 4, 5. And Edward O'Grady was the man who was flying the Irish flag there. And he's had longevity all the way from back in the early 70s all the way to recent times. And yeah, no, he was an icon of the sport himself. And yeah, he'll be greatly missed.
Okay, great. So, Don McLean, thank you so much for joining us this evening. That is all we have time for. Greg Allen was this evening's producer. Broadcast coordinator was Laura Lee Davis. The brilliant Beda da Silva is up next with the new music show. But first, we're going to check in with the news desk. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. I'll speak to you then.